Hello and welcome to a conversation with the man who's behind the audio for InHand Guides, the actual voice of the company, if you like. He's not the CEO of the company, but let's ask him his name and then I'm going to go over what he does, how he ever got into it, and we'll see where this goes.
We'll keep it on first name basis anyway. Okay, Paul, I'm Connor.
Right, Connor, lovely to meet you.
I've been the production manager for InHand Guides for the last 7 or 8 years, but I've been doing it on a freelance contract-to-contract basis. But I got a very nice Christmas present from Trevor, where he said, would you like to work a little bit more for us on a more regular basis? So he gave me a key in an office, and now I'm part of a small community of people working for Trevor in his office there, just on the outskirts of Cork City. But I also have my own studio here, which is where we are right now, yeah. At home, where I get to do all the production, the audio production. And it can be anything from a simple request from, say, the 9/11 Museum in New York. They just want another layer of production added on to their stuff before it's sent off to the factory in China, maybe to optimise their stuff or something, and get it ready for the in-hand audio guide player. To getting a text saying, Connor, you're going off to Blackpool next week, and you'll be meeting with the management over there, and then verifying
Blackpool Tower.
Blackpool over in
the UK.
Across the water,
absolutely.
And you'll be meeting a lovely tour guide over there who'll be telling you all about the history of the Wurlitzer and the Great Ballroom and what happened during the war and all that. And before you know it, it happened. I spent my birthday over there and it was bloody cold. I was finding myself immersed in the whole wartime history of the famous Blackpool Tower, until eventually we were able to put together a series of stories bringing us right up to the present, right up to Strictly Come Dancing and all of that. And out of that came their issue of another in-hand guide tour.
You've really captured my interest when you speak about the wartime aspect of that, because a really good friend of mine, Mark Cotton in the UK, is responsible for the Bletchley Park podcast. Bletchley Park is where the Enigma code was broken. Yeah. And Mark Cotton does the sound, plus a little bit of voiceover for Bletchley Park.
And when does this take place?
When does it take place? Yeah. About every month.
Every month.
About every month. So he's the guy I was telling you about before we came on to record this.
And he's
my good friend over there, and he'll be utterly thrilled to hear about this. But look, I've known your work in a kind of a slight way for about the last 4 years. I've heard your voiceovers.
Well, what happens is when I meet somebody, in some cases, like we went to Glasnevin Cemetery and I met wonderful Shane McTomas, historian, storyteller, passionate man altogether. And he took me on his particular tour of the dead centre of Dublin. And
the dead centre of Dublin. The most famous and the most historic graveyard in Ireland.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And a whole generation, many generations. And he told me the whole story from the very, very first grave right up to some of the great names, the crypts of O'Connell's crypt and everything like that. But
Daniel O'Connell, for those listening here, the great liberator, or whatever he was called, Catholic Emancipation, 1831 or something like that.
Oh, you know your history.
Well, but also his house is down in Kerry. And also his carriage is down in Kerry. That's worth a visit sometime.
That's what happened was I took most of the words that Shane gave me as an historian, as a tour guide, and turned them into a formal narrative script, which, to save a few bob, I voiced it myself rather than bringing in somebody who might be more famous or even, God forbid, brilliantly better than I am, says he, patting himself on the shoulder. But at the end of it, Shane did the last bit. I left that to him. I left the words to him, because when we went into Daniel O'Connell's crypt, it was just the sound of the keys going into the gate opening, the rattle of the keys, him walking the footsteps, the echo, and then eventually delivering the closing lines to this fascinating tour of Glasnevin. It had to be delivered by him. I couldn't recreate it. But that was the beginning of our working format, was that we're, for instance, in the Book of Kells, we met a guy called Paul. He took me around there. We took his words and we made a tour out of it, which was voiced by myself and also some lines using other actors as well would give it a bit more life.
Now, the book Kells, for those who don't know it, is visited by approximately how many people a year? It's way up there as the about the second after the Guinness Hop Store. It's about the second most visited place. Visitor,
I'd say hundreds of thousands anyway.
Absolutely, yeah, huge numbers.
So what we were able to do then, because we just had a narrator telling the story and just one voice, that was for English. And then we were able to translate that into French, into Spanish, into German. And so now all we had this new idea, which was like what I call the Babel fish, like a fish you stick in your ear. And it's not an original idea. Now we had this translating device. So you could take several people around at the same time. They're all listening to the same tour, but one of them's French, one of them's German, one of them's Spanish, one of them's listening to it in English, all at the same time. So suddenly now we're speaking in many tongues, like, you know.
Have you got a French person voicing the tour in French?
Yeah.
Right.
So
right.
Another guy. A lot of the people we use are actually people who used to work for the BBC World Service, and they're all, some of them based in London. So we work through them. And we just send over the material to them. I keep an eye on the quality of their work and more or less produce the same tour.
How did Trevor Winkworth, the CEO of In Hand Guides, first meet you?
Well, it was a mutual friend, and it goes back to my days in college in UCC. A guy called John McMonagall, and John runs a design company called Raven Design. John was also always a very talented guy. He was one of the kind of bunch of guys I knew. But he was on the periphery of the group. I didn't know he knew me that well, and didn't know him that well. But he knew of me, and he knew this is, as a voiceover artist, this is what I was doing. So he suggested me to Trevor when Trevor said, "I need somebody to voice this material for some of the tours that we will start producing ourselves." It was in the early days. So John gave me the job. We also have another. Sorry, I got the job because of John. But we have another mutual friend, and. He's a guy who's gone on to do quite well over in the United Kingdom as a chat show presenter.
And, really?
Graham Walker was the guy I knew when we were all in college. Graham was kind of a couple of years below me in UCC. And I remember talking to Graham the last time I met him was at a party in Dublin many years ago in Garvin McGrath's house. And 3 o'clock in the morning... There was a spare room with two spare beds in it. We both said, "We got to crash. This party's over now." Like, so I said goodnight to Graham. Graham said goodnight to me. And I says, "Well, what are you going to do?" And he says, "I'm going to go over to the UK and I'm going to make it big and I'm going to be famous."
He said that to you?
He did, yeah.
I never knew Graham was Graham Walker before.
Well, you guessed already, yeah, because that's the only thing he did was change his name. Yeah, so
fantastic.
That's why he comes back to Bandon every now and again. And I think they're actually going to build a statue in his honour.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, a statue in his honour in Bandon probably will stand beside, you know, a statue of Christy Ring somewhere else in Bandon.
And they'll be hurling abuse at each other, I'd say.
So you and Trevor met...
we didn't actually meet. It was a referral from just a person who knew both of us. And that's how I got to meet up with Trevor. Working a radio station at the time, I was able to... with the help of the production manager there, because I knew nothing about sound engineering at the time. All I knew was how to stand in front of a mic and read a script. So my then boss decided he had a studio at home and he produced the very first one. It was only until In Hand Guides were taken to London to do the London Eye that the world kind of woke up and went, "Oh, these guys... do a very good product." They've been taken seriously by Merlin Entertainment, who was one of the biggest companies in the UK, the entertainment business, Madame Tussauds and all that. So as soon as that happened, that became their calling card for further business, and it more or less kind of started to take off from there. And by then, I had started to learn more and more of the sound engineering side of things and started to build my own studio, which is where we are now.
In my language, we used to call that kind of learning sitting by Nelly. You know, you basically go in and somebody who is actually very expert at it shows you, then you have a go, you screw it up, then you have another go, you screw it up, and then you get it right.
Well, I actually learnt the very pleasant way. For a year, I produced mini murder mysteries for the radio station to go out over the breakfast show once a week. We produced over 60 episodes where we literally had a population of characters based on very loosely on Clouseau, on all the famous Miss Marple characters and all that kind of stuff. And I got all of these sales reps from the radio station and the newsreaders and some of the DJs as well, to play all the different parts that I'd written. And it was a 7 or 8 minute long piece, and you had to figure out who'd done it in the end, right?
Yes.
So the guy that used to do the editing for me suddenly got a job and with another radio station, and basically gave me a crash course on what he'd been doing all along. So I had to learn how to do it myself, or else I was out of a contract with the station because I was getting paid for each episode. And now I'd no editor anymore, so I had to learn how to do it myself. So that's how I learned the basics of putting together. And this is like a full drama for radio, because you had the characters and the sound effects, and you had to pretend that you were somewhere and all that kind of stuff. And we won an award.
Wow.
We won an award in, it's behind me there, I can't even remember the year, 2005 I think it was. Like,
yeah, I can see it on the wall. Let's just go over here. Say
PPI Radio Awards 2002 for Comedy Light Entertainment Mini Murder Mystery on Cork's 96 and 103 FM. Wow. It was a laugh. We had a good night that night in the Burlington Hotel.
Look, I want to ask you two more things, right? One is, I want, for the technical nerds, I want you to actually tell me what you as a sound engineer, and I see a mixing deck here and I see all sorts of things, but just would you quickly run through what you use? Because I do know a number of people who, from a podcasting and sound recording point of view, will be very interested in that. And then I want to go on to deal with 1916.
Technology has moved on considerably since 1916. In fact, I remember the first time I met anybody in a radio station whose job it was to edit. I remember the basic tool that he had was a scissors. And he had a reel-to-reel tape, and he basically, anything he didn't want in the finished product, he would cut out with a scissors, and he'd splice it back together with a little bit of sellotape, and he'd roll that back into the reel, and that's what they actually would broadcast, right?
Wow.
So he'd go up to a vox pop and he'd be cutting out all the bits and pieces, the ums and the ers and the ahs and all that.
The same as you did with films.
Exactly. So when digital editing came online, it was a lifesaver. And suddenly now, with just a mouse in your hand, you could just literally paint over a little bit of sound, hit a button, and it's gone, and it sticks the other two bits that were on either side of it back together again. Once you learn how to do that, it's very, very simple, because the only thing you'd add to a maybe bit of recording would be maybe a bit of music underneath it or some sound effects, and that means you're working with two tracks.
Yeah.
And if you take that principle then and you want to add something else, you've got three tracks and four tracks and five, blah, blah, blah. You mix them all together, and there you have it, the finished product. But once you learn how to cut something out and stick it back together again, you've got the basics. There's one brilliant program, this is for the techies now, Adobe Audition 3, and it was made available for free last January for the world. And there's just one little number that comes with it, you have to input it, it's the license, and then it's yours. And it's a wonderful, very intuitive editing suite to teach you how to do it, and I'll teach you how to use that.
Oh, fantastic. There's a microphone over right? Tell me what that is.
Well, that's one of the kind of industry standards would be what they call a Neumann mic. It costs, I don't know, 15, 1800, 2 grand or whatever it is. It's like a mic sitting in a little cradle, right? And it's a condenser mic, and it picks up the voice very, very sensitively. Unlike the microphones you'd see on stage or in a rock band where you see the guy sticking the mic right up into their mouth, this is the one where you have to stand back from it and you have to have a little filter between you and the mic, because it picks up your breath and everything like that.
And
pop
little
shield.
Bits of spit that come
It picks up everything. Yeah. It's very good. Yeah. And behind it, there's a little filter. It's called reflection filter, and that basically helps you sound like you're actually inside a booth. It deadens the sound, gets rid of any echo or anything like that. Very helpful altogether. So the mic I have is like one of those very expensive mics. It's just another make. So it's like not branded, but it does exactly the same job. And it goes into a little magic box, which basically goes into a Mac, and that goes onto a track, and that goes, gets edited, and it gets turned into an MP3, and it gets stuck onto an email, and then it gets sent off to a radio station, and somebody else adds a bit of music, and then before you have it, you have an ad. In my case, I use it as the laying the tracks for all of the guides that would involve my voice. There are other voices that would come here as well, but generally I try to do the narrative work if I can. I'll get somebody else in to do other languages or anything like that, and you just lay them together. So it's just layer after layer after layer. It's like making lasagna.
Right. Right, lovely. Look, we better move on to one of the most iconic days in Irish history, 1916. Well, now, this is coming down the track. This is before, it's not in the public domain yet, but come on, tell us about it.
Ironically, it's in Han Gein's first contract to itself, because up till now they've been taking contracts from other people, say the 9/11 tour in New York, London Eye in London or whatever it is, or the open top buses in New York, or various tours over in Canada, or the Niagara Falls, or various other countries around the world. But in this case, Trevor saw that there was an opening in Dublin for the 100th anniversary of the 1916 Rising for an audio tour, a walking audio tour of Dublin City, basically inviting people to the various sites where on one particular week in Ireland's history, a lot of people rose up, and militarily it was a disaster, but politically it was an ultimate success because it led to the independence of the country after a lot of pain. So we had the use of a tour guide called Lorcan Collins, who'd been doing a walking tour of Dublin in 1916 for the last dozen or so years. So he's featured heavily in this 1916 audio guide, which will be available fairly soon in places like the Shelburne Hotel and all of that. We're aiming it at the American market as much as the English tourist market and all of that. And bearing that in mind, there will be certain political sensitivities. Absolutely. We've put together a very, I would just say, there's a humorous side to it as well as a humane side to it, which kind of outlines the loss but also the gains. But the humorous side of it picks up on certain things like the park keeper in St. Stephen's Green wasn't very enamoured with all of these citizen army types taking over the green and finding themselves being ambushed left, right and centre from people, British forces firing from the Shelburne Hotel. They were completely outgunned and they had nowhere to hide, and God loved them, they were being slaughtered. And the park keeper wasn't... that wasn't what was bothering him, although he did try to talk to Countess Markovic about it. He says, would you please, just get out of my green, you're not going to win. He ended up setting up a little mobile hospital for them, looking after the wounded, giving them some tactical advice. But his real concern was, he was a champion duck breeder in his own right and had made a name for himself internationally. And it was the welfare of the ducks that he was most, I won't say most concerned about, but fairly concerned about. So as a result of that, every day during the 1916 Rising, he'd come out at lunchtime waving a white flag, and firing would stop on both sides while he went out to feed the ducks. And it was stories like that that have been unearthed.
And of course, you know what that reminds me and everybody else of is, wasn't it Christmas Day 1916 or 17?
During the First World War,
anyway. When the two sides stopped and came out and played a football match.
Yeah, they created their own ceasefire.
They did.
Finally, I'll just finish with one story, and it was about a man called Joseph O'Talloon. And I only got to find out about this when I rang a relative of mine and told them that I was working on this 1916 story, walking tour. And he says, I'd like to send you something that might be of interest to you. And it was a personal diary, 4 pages long, of one of the volunteers who actually was in the GPO, knew James Connolly personally, and actually told a lovely story on how Connolly sent him out with a sledgehammer to break a few holes in the joining walls of a terrace of houses near the GPO. So if they had to retreat, this was a tactic they had to be able to run in between houses without getting caught. So he was sent off to do the job. Connolly came along to inspect his work, tried getting into one of the holes, got stuck, had to be pulled out by his feet by Joseph. And Joseph O'Talloon, whose name was Joe Talon, by the way, tells the story that Connolly gave him a fierce berating altogether. This is, Joe, listen, we're not all as thin as you are. Make a bigger hole in the walls.
Lovely.
Another little sense of humour.
Yeah,
but that Joe Talon was actually my grandfather.
Oh, wow. Oh, what a lovely thing. Look, Conor, we're going to finish, right? And the only reason we're going to finish is that we have to do it in 20 minutes. But look, can I come back and talk to you more about the 2016 project in particular?
Because, as you say, it's just being built. It's going to be tested now in a few weeks' time. But there's other little stories that have started to come up. It's just a story that will never stop telling itself.
Well, look, Conor, thank you ever so much. It's been a real pleasure to meet you after so long. This is Paul O'Mahony handing back to the studio. Thank you very much for everything today.
Cheers, Paul. Great. Thanks.